Right. Good evening, everybody. This is the City Council workshop for the City of Bonnie Lake for September 20th, 2022. Let's call the meeting to order and salute the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, Madam Clerk, could you call the roll, please?
Mayor McCullough.
I'm here.
Deputy Mayor Carter.
Here.
Councilmember Baldwin.
Here.
Councilmember Evans.
Here.
Councilmember Fullerton.
Here.
Councilmember McClyman.
Here.
Councilmember Swatman.
Present.
And Councilmember Watson.
Here.
All right. Before we start with our presentation for Ride at Schools, I wanted to acknowledge the success that we had on Saturday for Beautify Bonnie Lake. It was a very good turnout, but for one politician who didn't have his glasses and didn't have his cup of coffee and was incoherent in speaking, it was quite a success, but at least he was short. So let's start with the presentation for Right at Schools. Mr. McEwen, could you start us off, please?
Yes. So as many of you know, the school district with Dr. Dent and the city have made a number of meetings and discussions on how to come together and rework and reconsider everything about our before and after and our recreation program. And one of the ideas that was put forth by council is a public-private partnership for before and after care. And we reached out to Right at Schools. We've listened to their presentation and had a very long discussion at one of our meetings. And we thought it would be beneficial for the council to hear from Right at Schools themselves and just also as a sanity check for us to make sure that we're going in the direction that the council is looking for. So with that, I'd like to introduce Cindy Lawson. She is the vice president of school partnerships.
Nice.
And she has a short presentation, and then we'll be able to ask her questions at the end.
And I am going to introduce Adam Case, who's our chief growth officer, and I'm going to have him kind of kick it off just
everything for
us. And then I'm going to finish it all up, so I figured I'd let him start if
that's
all right.
Thank
you.
Okay.
I will come in. I flew him in.
Hi, everyone. Adam Case. I'm the Chief Growth Officer for Right at School.
Hello.
Hi. And you met Cindy and then Courtney Caribou, our Senior Area Manager, oversees our programs in Puyallup and a number of other districts also here. So thank you for the time. We really appreciate it. I thought I would just talk for a minute about who we are and why we do what we do, and then Cindy will talk a bit more about the detail of the program. We started Right at School really because of what we saw for our own kids. Our CEO, Mark Rothschild, you know, walked in, his daughter was eating a bag of Doritos, watching a movie after school. I was the chief of staff of Chicago Public Schools, you know, and I would visit schools after school, and, you know, you come in and sort of over to the left, kids are playing a board game, you walk into the gym, you got a duck because the ball is whizzing by your head, which is sort of like the international sign of elementary school disorder when you have to duck when you go into the gym. And for me, it was like being in this sort of time war where I was right back in my own after-school program, you know, from 20 years earlier and really feeling like nothing had changed. And so we felt like we could do something better, more meaningful for children to really make that time count, really inspire a love of learning. We started with working with about 10 schools in the Chicago area. Today, we partner with school districts all over the country. We're with many of your neighbors, Yala, Pike, Derringer, and others throughout the state, and Cindy will share more. We serve about 30,000 students total. And two of those kids are mine. You know, I have a fourth grader, I have a first grader. They were in our after-school program today. They have been since kindergarten. So I speak about it and how we really think about what we do is, you know, as parents, because we are parents and our students use the program. That's the care that we take with all of the children we serve. And why that matters, I think, for my kids, for all kids, let's see if I can make this flip to the next slide.
You should just have to click on the screen.
There it is. Why that matters is turns out the children are awake for about 5,000 hours total. And of that time, they are in school for about 1,000 of those hours, so about 20% of their waking hours. So no matter how amazing their teachers are, and their teachers are amazing, their curriculum and the facilities and the structure, they have them for about 20% of that time. It turns out that for many children, between before school, after school, summer camp, and other programs, they are in programs like ours for a whole other 20% of their waking hours. And the question is, what is happening during that time? You know, is it high-quality enrichment that really inspires that love of learning, or is it more like babysitting, right? And our goal is really to maximize that time, to make it count, because we know how much power there is in that after-school time to engage children in really meaningful ways. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Cindy, who's going to talk a little bit about the research and about our program. And again, just thank you for having us.
Thank you, guys. Nice to see some familiar faces from the last time. It's nice to meet some of the new faces. Adam talked a little bit about why it's important, and obviously research shows that if children are in a real high-quality, balanced before and after-school program, these are what you're going to see. You're going to see higher executive functioning, better behavior and health, and the longer they're with us, if we get kids at that preschool K all the way up through 6, maybe 8, depending on what the need is, the longer they're with us, the more you will see that achievement gap close. And, you know, shake your heads as I'm talking, you know, and then we can talk about it more. But let me know if any of you have experienced this. A lot of programs fall short. You know, there's no curriculum. It's kind of like a glorified babysitting program. So as Adam mentioned, you might be throwing some balls, might get some homework done, might be doing some dittos or watching movies. And the biggest thing right now is staffing concerns, right? Like, staffing has always been an issue in this world, but seems to be just more prevalent now. And so what's happening is they're hiring people, and they're hiring younger people who aren't experienced, and they're just kind of throwing them into the program with no guidance, no structure, no training, and the next thing you know, they're turning around. And so there's this high turnover effect, but then also children, there's inadequate supervision, children are bored, and there's a ton of behavior issues that are happening. So when I talk a little bit about right at school, and then the other thing is there's these long wait lists. And when families need care, they need care. You know, so I'll talk about a little bit about my experience of being a single mom. I've been raising my kids physically and financially for 18 years on my own. And granted, they're old now, much older. I started when I was 14. My oldest is 28, so I'll just keep to that story. After school programs made all the difference in the world. Like, when my child was in a great after school program, it was incredible. But when not, I was getting calls at 3:15, and I'm in LA, you know, doing a day trip there, and my child's calling me bored, and they're struggling, and then I have anxiety, and I'm not very productive. So after school makes a huge difference in the lives of not only the children, but the parents as well. And then oftentimes, there's not a lot of options for families. You know, that equity and access isn't there for them. There's one rate. You come all or nothing. You know, there's no variety. So, and then sometimes districts try to run it their own, or cities will run it, and sometimes they don't have the resources, and it just becomes a financial hit, and that happened a lot. I have talked with districts across the country, primarily Washington and California, and a lot of districts who are running programs on their own lost a lot of money over these last 3 years. And so they've just been trying to get out of it and, you know, really work with companies that do this for a living. So does any of this resonate?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm seeing some head shaking. It resonates. You know, like I said, as a single mom, it happened to me. I know Adam had mentioned, you know, really how Ride at School started is because of Mark walking in and seeing his daughter eating Doritos and watching a video. So, you know, since 2010, we started Ride at School, and we service more than 35,000 students across the country. It was 30, but now 35,000 as of this morning's numbers. And, you know, our Washington partners, you guys might recognize a few of these districts, but these are the districts that we're currently partnering with in Washington. Something that we're really excited. So, and we also, I think as of today, might be adding on another district or two. So we've just got another district reach out. So something we're really excited about. So a lot of these, we're in the King County area. We're pretty prevalent in the King County. We're branching in the Vancouver area as well. Something that we're really proud of is for 3 years in a row now, we've been endorsed
as AASA's National After School Solution. And for some of you who might not know who AASA is, that's the National Superintendent Association. That's a huge endorsement from us and something that we don't take lightly. We think that it has to do with the work that we're doing around SEL. And we say SEL is really just making children feel like they belong, you know, making sure that they feel respected and valued in our program. And so we actually, one of our thought leaders, Dr. Dawn Bridges, actually sits on the National SEL cohort for AASA. So she's leading the conversation across the country, helping children, again, feel belonging. And when talking about SEL, we're really about building children up. We're here for the long game of education, so everything we do is about building these attributes that we know as educators will continue to unfold throughout their life. And you ask, well, how do you do that? There you go. We know the last thing a child wants to hear at 3 p.m. is, who wants to learn some more? They're like, no, we've been in school all day. We're done. So every year, children get to enjoy fresh new curriculum that's been written by our curriculum experts, who many were former administrators of their own. And every year they get to enjoy fresh, so it's 2-week thematic units. I brought a copy of a unit in case you want to see it. And they range from art to music to math to science. So all of these units, and they're very thought. Everything is intentional and everything is planned out from A to Z. So there is great curriculum. You'll see in here children are learning about Roman aqueducts, and they're using their design thinking as they build and test their models that have been made out of recyclables. You know, the biggest thing for us is we really want to ignite that spark and that joy in kids again. It's been a rough few years. We just want them to be kids and have fun, all while learning, right, but in a disguised approach. So that's why we call it disguised learning. So kids are engaged with hands-on, fun, project-based learning, but they have no idea that they're learning. They just think they're having fun. And that's really the concept of Right at School, and that's really what our curriculum is about. It's really important that we're entrenched in everything that's going on in the community. So we would have been at the beautification this past weekend as well. Everyone we hire is from your local community, and we join the PTAs or the PTOs. We provide free child care during those meetings, and we've seen about a 25% increase free of charge for families, potty trained and above. And so they can come and join and have their children be watched over, and they can go enjoy and participate in these PTAs. Any community events that are going on, we'll talk about water at walkathons, do face painting at carnivals, you know, whatever it is that we do, because we know the stronger our partnership is, the stronger our programs are. So we really want to be united. We even attend board meetings, and we'll probably, if we partner with you, attend these board meetings, and you ask, why do you attend board meetings? We find out a lot about the strategic initiatives by attending these board meetings, so how we can align. So a district is rolling out PBIS, Handwriting Without Peers, 21st Century Learning, whatever it is, we want to make sure that we're collaborating. We are servicing the same children, so that continuity of care is really important. We want to be speaking the same language, having the same conversations, making sure that when children are out on the playground, we're using the same words and following the same rules, right? So that continuity of care is important, and that's why we want to make sure that we align. We talk about people. Who do we hire? So there's 4 main places that we hire from. If there is a current program in place, those staff have the first right of refusal. And in this community, I believe staff make between $14 and $15 an hour. And at least that's what I thought and I looked at. And our assistants / educators, we call them, start out at 15 to 17. And our program managers are from 20 to 25. So some of the staff, if they were to come work with us and they have the first right of refusal, could make almost $9 more an hour. I mean, that's a lot of money. And then they also get their child care 100%. Right, Courtney? Okay, perfect. So those are that's the first right of refusal. People who are currently running, because the parents, families love the staff, right, already. So they would be able to come work with Right at School. We also hire a lot of paraprofessionals. A lot of people who are already working in the district, they already know the community, they already know the children, and then they get our great training and they get to bring it back into the schools. And again, the nice thing is when they work with us, they get 100% of their child care taken care of. So it's a win-win. We hire a lot of people who are going into education, who want to be teachers, who might, whether they have a degree in elementary ed, art, theater, music, somebody who has a passion for working with children. We want them to come work with us. So we'll work with a lot of the colleges locally and really partner with them with their education departments to bring their staff. And then hopefully sometimes they have a grow your own with the district where we kind of bring them on board and then give them back to the district after they've worked with us, because what we found out is first-year student teachers struggle with classroom management and curriculum implementation, and they get to hone in on those skills in our program and really practice them, and we set them up for success to go back into the school district. And then we hire a lot of retired teachers, because we're teachers never retire, let's just say. So they get to turn that hat around, and they get to be much more experiential, no more frontal. And so that's really the people that we hire from. And I already mentioned we pay quite a bit more because we don't want to lose somebody over the dollar. You know, we'd rather pay them and keep them and retain them. And we have some of the highest retention, something that we're really proud of. Once we hire them, we put them through this vigorous training of online and in-person. So they have to pass these assessment of modulars. So you can see a few of them on the screen below of some of the modulars that they have to pass. And once they pass the assessments, Courtney, our area manager, will get the notification that the staff pass, and then they can go on to live training. And live training is really a few days of a day in the life at Ride at School. It's scenario-based. We put out scenarios, and we really walk through what the experience would be from a child's perspective and how we can make sure that they're safe and they're engaged and they're having fun in our program. So it's not me sitting here talking to them or talking to you like I am. It's just much more of engaged. And you can see kind of our lineup. We have our educators. They're really kind of our teachers and assistants. We call them educators. And then we have our program managers, and every school has a program manager. They're kind of like a director. They run each school, and they report into an area manager, which would be Courtney, who reports into our regional vice president. And our regional vice president is actually from this community, born and raised. Her kids attended the school district in Sumner Bonnie Lake. Unfortunately, she had a medical procedure done and couldn't make it here this evening. So, but she gave her best, and she's been texting us all day, and she's probably watching it now. So, hi, Tiffany, if she is. Because she is from here. So she has known about the community and the need here and the waiting list that have been in her community. Her families talk about it all the time. Working with children with special needs. This is near and dear to my heart, having a child with special needs. We have two inclusion specialists on our team who work with families so that we can set children up for success. We want to make sure that we can acclimate them, and then our inclusion specialists work with the family and we'll do special accommodations in our program. So sometimes we have to have some headphones for sensory issues or tactical things. So they'll work with us to make sure that we provide the needs, things necessary to make sure every child is successful. Now, with that being said, unfortunately, we don't have the same funding that a school district has to be able to provide a one-on-one for a child. So if a child needs a one-on-one, we can work with the district, we can work with the community, and actually I just was at a district yesterday in Wiseburn, which is El Segundo, Manhattan Beach area, and there was a one-on-one with a kindergartner, and it was paid through for the family's insurance. So there's ways that we can go about trying to figure out how to get a one-on-one if it's needed. So now I get to talk about pricing. I saved that for last because that brought us the most questions in our last conversation, and we took up a lot of the time. So at Ride at School, the equity and access is really important to us. So it's really important that families have the option to come one day, 2 day, 3 day, 4 day, or 5 days. Post-pandemic, we're seeing a lot of 2 and 3 day families because some of them still get to work from home. So you can see right now the current structure is 5 day rates. So they can come 5 days before school, 5 days after, and 5 days before and after. So for those families who might, and these are monthly rates. So those families who might need care just 2 days a week, say they need care, you know, 2 days a week after school for before and after school, they'd save $200 a month on their tuition because we're able to provide that. In addition to be able to provide this flexibility, we have no wait list. So currently, we have historically not had wait lists, knock on the wood, in any of our programs. We hire to meet the needs of the community. Now, it doesn't mean that in the beginning of the year when we had 600 parents sign up August 1st and then August 3rd we have 800, we usually hire a little bit over, but at that point we might have to put some people in a little list until we can hire the need to meet up. But we always hire, and by, you know, October 15th, we're usually met the demands of the community for the beginning of every school year. We try to get families to enroll early, but it doesn't always happen, unfortunately. So we usually have to do some hiring. Puyallup, when we had started in Puyallup, there was only 286 kids, I think it was. And as of this morning, we're at 1,800 kids in Puyallup. Mm-hmm. And post-pandemic, we were at 1,500. So we were not expecting that. So, again, same thing with Bellevue. Bellevue took off again this year. So we're doing some hiring there. In addition, we would offer any school district employee 50% off their tuition. Again, we want those teachers and those administrators, whether they're custodians, school bus driver, whatever it is, anyone who works for the district would get 50% off. Anyone who works for the city, we just don't know how many cities and employees it would be, so we'd give them 20% off their tuition. That could go up. We just don't know if there's going to be 500 city employees who need it or 50. If it's only 50, we can probably go up in that percentage, but we just don't know what we don't know. So any city employee would get 20% off their tuition. Any family who's on free and reduced lunch would get 20% off their tuition. Any sibling or military, 10%. And we do accept state subsidies. So DSHS is the state subsidy. So families who qualify for that. We have people who work on our subsidy team who will help these families. Some of our McKinney Bento families, some of our other families, we will help them get on some subsidy as needed. And we also take military subsidy. So anybody who's in the military, also we accept that subsidy. So we accept all state subsidies. In addition, we would give the city, or whoever we contract with the city, 5% of our revenue. So any revenue that we make, we would give back 5% of it. So it's a win-win. You don't have to do anything. We do it all, but we'll give you a percentage of our revenue. And then we'll give 3% of our revenue back in scholarships. So we want to make sure that our neediest fams who might not qualify for the free and reduced lunch we'll get that. We've never turned kids away, especially our McKinney Bento kids. I mean, it's really important that we provide care and give them 100% scholarships in our program. So that is a rate. Again, that 5% is a number that we can look at going up as we go. We can go up to maybe as high as 8% down the road. We just don't know what we don't know. And when we transition into a new community, our upfront costs are about $20,000 per school, not including the staff. So we usually take a big hit year one, which is fine. We know we'll make up for it. So that's why we were saying that 5% revenue share and 3% scholarships when we initially start, and it's something that we can revisit down the road. So with that being said, we take care of everything. This is all we do for a living. So we don't do 100 things okay. We do one thing really well. We have 2 full-time recruiters in the state of Washington that all they do is recruit for our positions. So year-round recruiting, we're constantly recruiting, we're constantly hiring, we're constantly developing and promoting our people in the state, and we're growing. And so it's something that we're really excited about. But we do it all. You know, training, we need a, you know, space in the school, and Lori and I have already, you know, we've talked about it. She's actually probably talked with about 15 of our current partners and can validate that what I'm saying is true. So, because she has asked a lot of questions from them to make sure before she even mentioned our name to you guys. So, with that being said, we are here to answer any questions that you have. And I tried to get through that as quick as possible, but I didn't have the clock to really answer.
that's
I should have been looking over at your computer.
That's where we save money, is we're not repairing. Before we open up to the floor for questions, I do have one question, as you know, this is a alliance that we're doing with the city of Bonnie Lake and hopefully the city of Summers doing with the school district itself. And what I noticed in your presentation is that it was all kind of district public school based, and we have a lot of homeschooled citizens in our city. How does it work with our homeschoolers, or would they be welcome in the program, or how does that work?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, they can be welcome in the program.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
All right. Now,
we want to provide the transportation.
Right.
But they're more than welcome to come to any of our programs. As long as the district and the city is okay with them attending the program, we're good with it.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. Councilmember Evans.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Chuck, for putting this all together. This is what I've been looking for the last 5 years. And it's amazing. The presentation was great. I'm looking at our current cost that the city does at $425. And looking at the minimal cost there of...
Oh, the presentation's not up. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
I could move back to the pricing slide. I have the current rate on there.
445, I think, is what it showed, or 444. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're talking the difference of $1 a day for this level of care and education versus, you know, the busted crayons in a eighth generation coloring sheet like I've seen at my daughter's school. So I think this is definitely the way to go. My question to you is, of all of the 35,000 that you work with, what percent are municipalities versus school districts?
Adam, Jim.
Definitely, we don't have a preference of who we contract with, if that's the question.
No, I'm just curious who normally...
School district.
The school district.
Yeah, 99%.
Okay.
So, we've had a few of these situations where, you know, it's been through the city and in my previous world. And again, that was something that we talked about with Lori because, you know, we could go directly through her, but we thought we would do the politically correct way and see if we could go through the city, if that was something that was interesting. So
yeah, I appreciate that. 5 years ago, the school district came to us, and that's how we ended up with it. But 5 years ago, I think there are a few of us here that were pushing back on that, saying that, you know, education belongs to the educators, you know, not the legislators. And you know, as good of a job as we've done, it's not adequate enough for what is needed to be done and what you guys can provide. And, you know, I think the school district, anything involving the kids and education, I think should fall under the educators' realm of thing. That's why I was asking if that was majority. I would love to see this program added to the school district's plate back on them for that, since it's their children in their facilities. And, you know, having our hands in the cookie jar is unnecessary for 5%. I'd much rather see it go back to the kids in the school district for where it belongs. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you for the question.
Good. Oh, Councilmember Fullerton.
Yeah, so it was my understanding, like, the 5% was for that would actually, because we would still at this point probably have Parks and Rec. And so that would, and the before and after care did subsidize the whole Parks and Rec program to keep the costs down for families to be able to do all the sports and everything. So that 5% would actually help subsidize to keep the cost down. And I talked to Superintendent Dr. Dent, and she was like, I'm all for, if you're going to continue to run the before and, or the Parks and Rec, that she was all for giving us that 5% to make up for the loss of the subsidies from the before and after care. But so 5% really isn't that much, but we only had what I think we've got only got like 300 students or something in our before and after care program. But with right at school, they would be able to go. We only are using 8 schools at this point. They would be able to use every single school building. So the kids don't have to be shipped back and forth between school. So we're saving on bus transportation. We'll be saving on the HR department. We won't have to do any of the hiring. We won't have to pay out of the city's pocket for any of the employees because they would all go through the right at school. I keep forgetting what I'm talking about. Sorry. And then also they do all of the background checks, and the background checks can also be tightened, I believe, if we had extra concerns, but they're accredited, correct? It's like a
state license. Yes.
Yes.
You have to go through rigorous background checks.
Absolutely.
State, local, all of it.
Okay. And then when you're talking 300 students that we have currently, which is probably going to increase when you don't have to worry about transportation to and from schools, like Puyallup went from, what, 260 to 1,800, that 5% adds up, especially when you're not paying for the employees. They're not being government employees anymore, and they do have right of refusal, so the people who are running the program right now would probably get a pay raise and have the right to first refusal. So, I mean, and then we don't have to pay anything out of pocket. We're not running it, but we would have that 5% to help us with the Parks and Rec Department, because I believe that's still going to be under the city, and that would help us subsidize those sports and everything else. So.
Okay. Councilmember Baldwin.
I had a couple of questions. Thank you so much for that presentation. I am piggybacking on Councilmember Evans. I kind of have the same thought process as far as, is this a partnership that's being sought to then be together with the municipality, or is it then for the school district? So I'm still trying to figure out which route the plan is.
That's whatever. Currently under us, so if
I see.
We'd have to work out something with the school.
Okay. I think my other question is just more, I guess, just the, as far as content is concerned. My question is in regards to, you know, I think about after school, and I think the biggest concern that I think of, and I did see that some, you had a post on there that some things can become maybe too academic, for example. And so I think my first concern is, you know, are the kids then going from school and then they're shifting into after school to more school, you know? And so, and I know it said that it doesn't do that, but you do have things like math and science. And I teach science. You know, so I think it's, yeah, I just wonder, is that then, you know, because I think in today's age, a lot of kids aren't being kids after school. They're not playing. They're not outside. They're on devices. They're on computers. And so I guess my concern is, like, are they at school and then they're going to shift into an after-school program where they have the option to then be on a device again or a computer again or to do more work, if that makes sense.
We typically don't have computers or devices in our program.
Okay.
Or TV.
Okay.
We don't allow them. And to your point, we want them to be kids.
Okay.
So that's why we have a whole curriculum division that gets to have fun in our corporate office and play. So it's about how do we do science, but in a fun way.
Yeah.
How do we do it where it's fun for the kids and it doesn't feel like it's science?
Okay.
So you'll see on our page 2 of one of our units, here's all the standards that are being addressed.
Okay.
We don't show this to kids. We show this to parents or administrators or the city if they want to see it, but we won't show this to kids.
Okay.
So, but you, if you read through, I can stand hand this around, or I can email, I think I emailed some curriculum samples so you can actually see how much fun it is,
okay,
but how we disguise it so that it doesn't feel like more of the same.
Okay.
Because it can't. We're very adamant that it doesn't look and feel the same as school.
Okay.
And so there's plenty of time for autonomy and downtime. We go outside any day that we can. And even if we can't go outside, we'll do indoor activities. And Chicago Public Schools are K-8 schools, and so they have us running their recess programs.
Okay.
So we have manuals like this of games and activities and fun things that we can do with children.
Okay.
That will keep them engaged. But no, it does not look, and really important for us that it does not look and feel the same as school.
Okay. I think that's great. I did have one more question, ma'am.
Sure.
Okay. So I think the last question is, you know, I think on a system like that where you have, you know, people you've trained, especially for children with behavioral issues, I think my question then becomes, because you say that you don't turn anybody away, but then what happens if you're in a situation where you have a student that has exceptional behavioral problems and they're affecting, like, other children and things like that? Like, how is that managed?
So first off, if there's a child who has been identified in the school who has an IEP, we ask the parent in the school if we can partner with them on IEP meetings, right? So we want to work together to make sure that we're all on the same page. We're all having the same conversation. We have our own progressive versus positive versus progressive guidance form.
Okay.
So what we'll do is, obviously, we want children to be safe. We want them to have fun. But we always know that there could be some behavior issues. So on the first instance, we'll talk to the family, talk to the child, try to work through it. Second instance, we'll come in, have a meeting, see if the teacher wants to come, have that conversation, and we'll create a form where it talks about, hey, here, and get the parents, but what can we do different? How can we do anything? Is there anything you can advise us? What can we be doing differently with this child? So we'll put some practices in place, and then we'll come up with a plan. Like, if this happens again, the child will have to be suspended. If it happens again, he's home and suspended the next day, and by the third time, he has to be disenrolled.
Okay.
We do disenroll children. It's not often. And it's not without trying to really make sure.
Yeah, but there's a process.
There's a process.
Yeah,
there's a place
okay.
Where we get that we would have to disenroll children.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do we have any? Councilmember Watts.
Thank you. Good presentation. It's very encouraging. How do you handle the transition going from our current program to your program when the students aren't used to what you're doing? This is a real challenge for them, I would think. How's that handled?
Well, funny enough, we get calls all the time. I've probably had about 50 calls from your district over the last 5 years from here who come from Puyallup or other areas and who were in our programs before. But we'd educate them. So we have a marketing team. We have a team. I would be involved from the entire process from A to Z. So we would hold transition calls. So whoever would be the key point of contact, we'd look at doing transition calls, but usually weekly until we'd open. Some transitions, we talked about maybe January, we'd have to know really soon if we did a January transition. We'd have to know, I think Courtney said, by the first week in October. If not, it would be a school year transition come August or September when you start back to school. January is not off the board, but it would have to be made quickly. So we would just work with you in the community, and I would do a parent information night, a virtual one, where I would come on and get families excited about the program, talk to them, and then talk them through the transition. And then obviously we would be doing a lot of hiring and interviewing current staff or new staff behind the scenes. And so it's a process. Adam, is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
I think that's just for all of us as parents, right?
Typically, once we decide, we find out what events are going on at the school, and we are there as many times as many events that we can attend. We start talking to parents, educating them, easing their fears. Oftentimes, it's between the announcement and my parent information night where the most noise happens, where parents are unknown. And once my parent information night comes and I inform them and they see the prices and the program, it's usually crickets after that. So I try to host that virtual parent information night within a week and a half to 2 weeks after the announcement comes out. So announcement will come out and say, hey, by the way, don't worry, we're going to have an information night by Ride at School. They'll be here to host. Here's the Zoom link you can click on, and we go from there. And then usually after that, parents' minds are at ease, and, you know, you won't hear from us. And then they would start calling us.
And are your teachers pretty well same teachers all the time for those students? Or are you changing them around quite a bit?
We try to keep continuity of care in our program because it's important for children. Oftentimes the district does hire some of our children from the community. We usually ask if we can have them for a year before they hire them from us. But we have a lot of times where the district will actually hire them. It's a win-win. They're going to a different school, but we try to keep them as secure as possible with their teacher stability.
Thank you.
Councilmember Evans?
I believe Kelly had his hand up.
I was wondering about that. Councilmember McFine, and then I have another question after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you turn the camera back on? I can't see anybody.
Oh.
Technical difficulties.
We did that as a favor to you, Councilman.
I know, right.
Need to look at us. Mom's hat was flashing.
But you're also very charming.
There you go.
Most of you, anyway.
Oh, come on, Kelly. Not again.
Councilman Fullerton, you had a question?
Yeah. I was wondering about the summer program.
So it kind of looks and feels a little, it's just extended of our year program. So disguised learning activities, we just do more of them. Oftentimes we'll do field trips. I'm not sure with COVID how that's going to work this summer, but we'll do field trips. But if not, we'll do in-house stuff. But they're also instead of 2-week thematic units, they're a week thematic unit. So we have a different week thematic unit, and it's just fun and engaging, probably similar to some of the programs you're running during the summer.
Hmm.
Just getting them outdoors as much as we can, getting them active, getting them moving. And then if we have a theme, we'll usually try to do a field trip that matches the theme. Like we've been to a few baseball games, right? Like we've gone to – yeah, so we've gone – so we'll do a lot of field trips as well. So usually coordinate a field trip with whatever the theme is of that week, whether it's a museum or something like that.
Okay, Councilmember Evans. This one's for John. Our current staffing at before and after is represented, is that correct? If we brought them on and they remained under the coverage of the city, is there a liability there in a grievance?
We'd have to bargain it with the union.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, and with that, Dr. Dent, I did have a question. And Chuck, with all this, I know that we're having regular meetings on this. I did, I'll get more into timing of IEPs and when we actually have a time frame for this, but that's what I'm wondering about right now. Now that if we do decide to adopt the program, are we looking at expediting the time frame on this to beyond August of next year, or what are we looking at?
Well, as Cindy alluded to, they would really need a contract in 10 days in order to facilitate a January start in the school district, which would be very tight in terms of getting something like that through.
You've taken it on in less time, Chuck.
Yeah. However, that does run into a timing consideration as far as our bargaining with our represented employees, which may conflict here on that.
And that's, yes, although we wouldn't actually be starting, and they would not start until January, so it still gives us a number of months to come to some sort of a minimal agreement. We had spoken also about the ability to possibly start with the summer as opposed to in the fall. That would give the parents sort of a sneak peek at what Right at School can do, as well as kind of drum up that interest and that support during the summer. So that's another possibility, not having to wait till August.
Okay, and if we do start in the summer, what kind of time frame are we looking at as far as
signing
up?
By the end of the year, we'd like to know.
Okay.
By the end of this year.
End of calendar year.
End of calendar year. Okay. December.
Right. All right. Well, guys, Councilmember.
There's still future discussions on who's going to manage this, right?
Oh, yes. Okay. There are future meetings.
On this Friday is our next joint meeting with the school district.
Okay.
Okay, so it's up to y'all when you want to put this on the
Well, I would like to encourage that discussion include the transition back to the school district and allow them to make the decision on if they wish to choose Right at School for their before and after care provider.
Is that one of the things that's going to be discussed, Chuck?
Yes, and we have already discussed that as an option.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So as far as where we go with this, do we want to put it on next week's agenda, or do you want to continue it out a little bit? In other words, trying to start this in January or trying to start it during the summer?
I would rather have confirmation if this will be a school district decision and not a council decision.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, and we'll know that by Friday.
Yes.
Okay.
We need to have Lori, were you going to ask Lori something?
I actually did it to, I kind of did a cross reference here, and because you didn't have a microphone, I went that way. So.
I think it's a little more complicated. You
micro, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want my microphone?
I'll do a little more complicated than just a meeting on Friday.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That have to be rewritten. There are some, like our board has to take action. So
yeah.
A little more complicated, but. Mm-hmm. Like Justin said, we've done this in less time, so.
Yeah, I was a little surprised you had the time frame.
I mean, our extension goes through the end of August of next year, so
right.
I wouldn't be advocating for a push of a January transition date. I would be fine with fulfilling the one-year extension that we alluded to back in January.
All right.
To allow proper time.
Customer Fulton.
Yeah, so are you also thinking about taking the whole entire Parks and Rec department and putting it back towards the school, or are you just talking about before and
just
after?
Just the before care? And after care.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So, because I was thinking that was what Dr. Dent was referring to before as far as the 5% was that could go back to the city to help subsidize the Parks and Rec department. The before and after care did subsidize the Parks and Rec department so much before, because most of the majority, like 800,000, went towards or came from the before and after programs.
Yeah.
So that helped to keep the cost down. So that 5% would help us, but there's also the different things that we don't have to take care of anymore. So that kind of helps take away some of the money that was going towards the before and after care, and now it's just all going to be like the 5% will be the profit that we can use towards subsidizing and not have to worry about staffing and resources for the city and all that. So I think that would be really under the school, but we would be getting the process. But
if we're managing it, it's not the school district's decision to give us back our 5%. What I'm saying is I'd like to give them the whole project and let them keep the 5%,
mm-hmm.
As the management fee for that, and us be, completely out of it as far as an entity. And if there's a contribution that needs to be made, like what we did 6 years ago, you know, with Sumner in supporting some of that before and after school care. You know, I think that's a discussion worth having. But, you know, as far as the role of government and municipal government, I don't believe before and after school care. Previously, I would say child care. But I know with this program, it's not so much child care as much as what it currently is. And this is actually a educational component that, you know, I've been an advocate for. So I would much rather fall under the 90% of what Right at School does with mm-hmm. the school district managing that portion of things.
All right. Yeah. Well, it sounds like, and I do agree, not that I can really render an opinion here, but there is a lot that still needs to be discussed and hammered out. And so as far as what we do as a council, I just think it should be tabled until we're ready to get more information for everybody, and then we can go from there. Deputy Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you for that presentation. I appreciate it as well. I guess my question had to do with Councilmember Fullerton's question as far as what was it costing us for the Parks and Rec program, if that's a standalone program, what was that going to cost us?
That's going to be kind of difficult to quantify right now because we're not sure what the staffing level would be if this program was removed. So it's something that we would work with finance to kind of narrow down before we were able to really give that number back to you.
Okay.
All right.
And with that, I mean, a lot of the stuff is contracted out with the basketball and the soccer and, you know, where there aren't the costs are covered by the participation of it. So
right.
We have to possibly look at raising those rates or figuring something out to
offset. That would be kind of my concern as to what are those rates going to look like, what is that going to do because we are losing out. Because one was kind of helping pay for the other one, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah. I'd just be curious as to what those numbers are.
Okay. Councilmember Fullerton.
Yeah, also, we would have to, because right now we partner with the school district and they provide all of the buildings and things like that and the playgrounds and everything for the Parks and Rec Department. So we would have to see if that is something that they're still willing to do if we're not running the before and after care.
Okay. And
it's a lot to discuss.
That's a part of future discussions. Dr. Dent, I'll probably be sending you an email on there Friday so that I can back up what Mr. McEwen is saying. All right. Well, thank you for the presentation.
So
it was most informative. I'm glad to hear about it.
Thank you for letting us come.
Yeah. No, this is great.
We appreciate being here.
All right.
Cool.
Yeah.
Like
good.
Like this, so I'll take it up.
There you
thank
go.
You
and
so
you
much.
Educated yeah. about it. Yeah. City Councilman.
Nice meeting all of you. Thank
nice meeting you, too.
If we go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Don't
thank you all. Have a good day.
Yeah,
oh, you too. All right. Now we're moving on to the council open discussion, and I will hand over the floor to Councilmember Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. As you alluded to the beginning of our tonight, group here tonight, Unified Mayan Lake was a huge success. They had over 600 people come to the park and go to 20 sites in the city. The staff was phenomenal getting ready for us. And afterward, getting things put away, I couldn't ask for any more. A lot of people involved, a lot of hands going.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if any issues at all we ran into. A lot of sites were taken care of. They received a lot of money and things getting cleaned up, getting the right places. We had a lot of school students out there helping pull weeds. And I was told they were being instructed by those students how to pull a weed properly. And I just took it out. Well, in the dirt, the whole thing out at once. So that was phenomenal that way. So it was just, I have no problems. I just want to thank you and all the staff and everyone works so hard to put together. And it was really good for us. So I'm looking forward to our 20th year next year, which is even better. And I won't be in charge of it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Councilmember Watson. I do recognize, especially on Saturday, all of the hard work that is a year-round process
yeah.
and getting it done for the one day that we did, and that certain people did show up at like 5:30 in the morning to help.
Yes, I was there
with that. And as an aside, I thought I was working a little hard of running things, everybody, until I saw Councilmember Baldwin and her daughters holding up this huge bag of weeds and everything, taking it to the place. So I was certainly humbled by that.
And you all know Dr. Dent was out there, too.
He was.
Yes.
Pulling weeds and asking what weeds to pull and bags of weeds down at Victor Falls.
Oh, she left.
It was, you know, their staff was all over the place out there. So it's a great combined effort of our citizens, the city, and the school district all involved. So thank you.
Absolutely. Do we have any other further open discussion? Councilmember Ball.
I just wanted to piggyback on that and just I had already told them, you know, in person, but what an excellent and very highly organized just machine. I was really impressed, especially with so many people showing up. And, yeah, you guys handled it so well. It was just – it was so smooth, and it was a lot of fun. So
thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Do we have anything further?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Councilmember Swatman.
Yeah, you know, I agree completely. Ditto that. Of course, that's a you know private organization, right? Beautify Bonnie Lake 501c3. Anybody can contribute to that, please do. Or
sure
don't,
can.
Whatever. They did, made it look easy, right? Excellent example of a great partnership between local government and a private organization. 501c3 it is. They make it look easy, right?
Oh, they did.
It was also a second note, a separate subject. I recommend, of course, you know, and I think the mayor is very well aware that, you know, if there's staff that's here that has other things to do at these workshops, and, you know, please let them go if you want, right?
Oh, I'm agreeing with that.
If there's, you know, they don't need to stay here for me. If I'm going to talk about council policies and procedures, And your staff has other things to do, feel free to say, hey, you know.
That is a point well taken, Councilmember Swatman. We do have employees that part of their duties is to be here. So.
Yep, that's your thing, thing to run. Thing three. I did recognize, of course, you know, the citizen came the other day, was talking about water rates and, you know, of course, utility rates, sewer rates and that thing. And I think that study is going to be coming back here in a little while.
About 2 weeks, is that correct, Ms. Bonfitch? Or three?
About a half.
Okay.
That'll be great to see. There's a lot of work hopefully we'll be able to do in that area. You know, I'm one of those on the very edge of reality on that subject. So it'll be very interesting to see what the council wants to do with that. I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit kind of disappointed that we haven't done something with that already. We did make some movement, which is very nice to know already, on making sure that the water rates didn't increase as they could have. However, you know, again, I'd like to see the water rates and a bunch of different changes be made there as soon as we can. And of course, I think people generally show up when their bills come, right? So that's probably why people were coming at this time of year saying, hey, what are these big water bills? Well, that's what it is. Anyways, enough with that subject. Thing four. Alan York parking. I put that on there, did I? Yikes. We did discuss that in CDC a little bit, but there is, of course, that's one of those issues that's going to parlay into item number five here, possibly, this park study thing that we're doing. And the Councilmember Baldwin had an outstanding discussion at our last workshop, right? Hard to do when you're remote, by the way, in my opinion.
Over. I couldn't see any of your faces. At all.
And Councilmember
McClain's
in the same boat. So.
Right?
We did that for 10 years.
Oh, my goodness.
But specifically, you know, on the piece of that, because you were referring to a lot of the park problems, but there's that parking issue that for the boats that we're going to go through that we touched on CDC, and that'll still be obviously a full council kind of thing in there and a decision card associated with that parking level. But there is, of course, the one of the points that's been mentioned on that is, like, how many boat slots are you going to come up with, right? So at some point in time, somebody somehow is going to have to come up with a number, because if we're going to try to allocate what kind of parking we want to do down there for boats, if we want boat trailer parking, which I think everybody does at some level, there's a wide range there, right? And it's really hard to kind of go forward with much without knowing if we're shooting for 150 slots, or are we going to say 80 is good? That's good, right? So that's an important number, and I don't know how we're going to get there. We need to get there pretty soon. Because
mm-hmm.
there's, you know, it's allocated on the project size. There's a large money difference there. And that probably leads me into that other one that, again, the CDC discussion tonight, and the CDC did recommend that we're going to come down to full council, of course, because it's a big issue with that park study, right? the full park study that Jason has done an awesome, superb job putting together.
Yes,
finding
thank
a
you,
great consultant to help us deal with the park study, you know, the big one. And they kind of phased it, right, because the council did have a concern about, you know, Alan York specifically. You know, what do we do with Alan York? And that's part of the bigger plan to figure out what we can do down there. But as great as the discussion was with Councilmember Baldwin, I'm still trying to figure out if you're focusing on Alan York. You know, I didn't get the problem. What's the problem, right?
Yeah.
You know, define the problem. I know that, you know, and what I said at committee level is people say, yeah, I don't like the park, and they run around, and they're like, okay, well, that's great. I agree. There's problems. But what is the problem?
Mm-hmm.
Because what we have, in my opinion, is a park plan that's coming down that's really big. It's really big, and it's cost a lot of money because the scope is really big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and without the council in my mind, and again, this discussion, future discussion soon, you know, this FYI of a preview of get some scope on that thing, you know. What do we want to do? Is it, you know, there's people, was there an, you know. Is there an actual, like, problem?
Yeah, I'd love to reply.
Yeah,
I think the two things that I didn't get a chance to say on the computer up there is it is definitely the number of spaces that's needed. Like, there needs to be a decision as far as how many boat trailers is necessary down there,
mm-hmm.
and we can't decide. I think the second thing is, you know, in talking with Chief Jeter, you know, I think one of the main things that they keep mentioning over and over and over again is just the ability for boats to be able to launch off that dock, and just the size of the road and just the way there's just a lot of problems and backup and issues and dangerous situations that are happening there. Longer term, you know, so I think that's the short term that Jeter and I were talking about, is those two things. But I think long term, one of the big things is, you know, the potential rerouting of some of those roads.
Right. Yeah.
Because they're just,
I agree, right? You know, and that's part of that conversation.
But I know that's a lot of money.
Well, and that's where the strange, and it's kind of probably maybe not a discussion for here, but it's like, yeah, I agree 100%. We should reroute the road, you know, undoubtedly. That is a no-brainer, right? It will cost you, you know, I don't know, $15 million. Check. Good? Okay. And that's that kind of weird discussion that I just, like, you know, my head falls off. I'm like, well, you don't have $15 million.
Right.
Do you?
No.
I don't. I'm not going to fund it.
Yeah.
Justin might.
Yeah. No, yeah. I was
on Howard Fund. No, sorry, nobody.
I remember Ed.
So that's how that weird thing is that, you know, you literally, they're talking about paying the consultant $60,000 to tell you, yeah, it's a great idea if you can move that road.
Mm-hmm.
Would it just be the rerouting of the road, or would it be the...
No, there's lots of things.
Okay, yeah, because I think the rerouting of the road is still long-term. That's still the long-term.
But is it?
Well,
I would challenge
know.
That, right?
I don't know. I don't know that would be a short...
We actually drew it out. We there's several of us that have drew it out and actually kind of done some research on it.
I would be amazed if we could accomplish in the short term.
No, it's not short term. I'm just saying.
Oh, okay.
So I think Sadie would say on a rabbit trail. So I'll shut up. I'll shut up now. But that's a preview of the discussion, right? You know, that's one of the things I think we need to.
What you talked about.
That scope, because otherwise you have a $300,000 investment in a parks plan for the 13th time that nobody's ever done anything with, and nobody
gotcha.
Ever will.
Yeah.
Councilmember Fulton, you have a
shut up now.
one of the future discussions would be the idea of going under and then making that whole road, West Taps Road, can be all part of the park, and then you go under and then you don't have to have a stop sign. You just make a tunnel.
I agree.
And
we've talked to
be...
Seattle about getting their like boring machine. They said you can come pick it up any day. And that's not
right
like facetious.
Aaron Connect makes the boring machines right there in Sumner.
No, there's one that's already there in Seattle. It's just
I forgot the name of it. What is it? Seattle Sadie or
Bertha?
Yeah, hey, Bertha. That's
available. You just have to transport it.
It would be a lot cheaper than rerouting and trying to redesign the whole park. You could just make it all the park and make that road disappear, and then they
that's
don't even
cover.
Have to
like
cross the street. They just It's all park.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Do we? I'm trying not to speak over people. Do we have any further open discussion? We do have a couple more presentations, I believe, from Mr. Sullivan, who is a man of few words. So.
Good luck, Jason.
So anyway, if we don't have any further open discussion, we will now have. Oh, first of all, we need to have a review of the council minutes. I would love to ask somebody besides Councilmember Watson, but your name always shows up.
We have an issue. We took care of it.
Okay,
very minor though.
Thank you, Councilmember Watson. Okay, now we have a discussion item for AB 22-115. Mr. Sullivan, I do hand the floor over to you.
Wait till Sadie's done doing all.
Ta-da.
Not me.
In. All right, are we ready?
Yep.
All right, so long awaited, we have the actual Peak 410 development agreement before the city council tonight. This has been a long time in coming, and it is another great example of private-public partnerships to achieve a lot of a kind of grand goals that I don't think that the city ever thought would be happening when the East Town Plan was adopted some 20 years ago. This whole thing kind of kicked off when the city kind of declared the Compass Point property surplus. We then, in September of 2021, received a development agreement application from Chris Lear and his group to begin negotiating a development agreement that would come to encompass nearly 50 acres of property. The City Council passed Resolution 2994 back in November of last year, directing staff to prepare a development agreement and negotiate that development agreement with Chris Lear and also develop a purchase and sales agreement for the transfer of the Compass Point property. We have been working for nearly a year on this. I think when Chris and I started, we thought it would be quicker, but every time we turned one corner, we found four more that we had to figure out how to fix. So,
Mr. Sullivan, could I stop you for just a second? Mr. Lear, would you mind coming up and sitting next to the microphone? I know we have a few questions, and it'd be better to talk into the big microphone.
I didn't know Chris was being on the spot, so I apologize.
I didn't warn you, so pull my hair.
Yeah.
All right.
Me too.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan.
And since then, we have been working diligently with a number of city staff. It's not just me. It's been Ryan, a lot of people from public services, and I know Chris has assembled a great team, so this has been a big team lift. We did brief the council kind of generally on the 28th of June. Now we're here to kind of present that year's worth of work in the development agreement. So the project kind of in general is a 50-acre business park with about up to 850,000 square feet of light industrial, light manufacturing, and office-type uses. About 20 of those acres come from city-owned property, and about 30 acres come from the developer. About 10 of those acres is out in unincorporated Pierce County, and we've been able to actually coordinate with Pierce County to streamline the permitting process, and I'll get into that a little bit later. The ideal is that the facilities are large, and also in order to reduce the visual impact on 410, the buildings are actually going to be stepped into the site. So from 410, they look like one story, but from the backside, you'll have about 60 feet of clear space. So we'll be able to open this up to a lot more national tenants because having 63 feet of clear space within the warehousing is really advantageous. But from a visual impact, it will still look like a one-story building because of some of the topographies on the site. We're really hoping this will foster kind of and put a stamp of putting Easttown as a light industrial center out there, in addition to what we already have out there. We're looking at adding about 700 new, what we call family wage jobs, so not just retail service jobs, but jobs in which support family wages and people living in the community. I was just doing some quick math right before the hearing. Just the construction sales tax dollars alone on this project, from the road infrastructure and the building infrastructure, the city will receive about $1 million in sales tax revenue just from the construction side of this over the next 5 to 10 years, depending on how long it takes to build out. So what does the agreement actually discuss? And I'll try to go through this as quick as I can, but also when we're done, we can answer questions about any of those topics. So the development agreement does get into kind of the development regulations. One of the nice things about a development agreement and what's allowed by state law and our code is we're allowed to take a development agreement, and those areas where our code and the project are aligning exactly right, we're allowed to create flexibility within our code. So what we are doing is we are vesting the project to our current development regulations for the life of the agreement, except for fees. The fees will be whatever they are, where they come into pay, whether it's traffic impact, permit fees, building permit fees. We did tweak the MAP streets ordinance. We had a big briefing about that and removed part of the MAP streets that goes across the RCL site. And I can go back real quick and show that. There used to be a proposed road that would extend all the way across the site, but because of the way the site lake worked out, we didn't need to do that. So we're terminating the road kind of right here at that joint line and allowing the – oh, the next line, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry, all the way over here.
Told you we
needed. Yeah, thanks, Chris. He knows this probably better than I do.
Yeah. I spent 3 years
here. Yeah. So that there's still the access to 410. There's still the frontage road concept. But it doesn't impact the bay layout on those other sites, and those tractor trailers can drive around the site but still access that public road. In addition to that, we did create some flat parking rates that we worked with Chris on so we wouldn't have to go and revisit this every time there's a project. Tweaked a little bit of our bay door standings for some of the rear-facing buildings. Did a lot of work on urban forestry, and I'm not going to go into all the details. I can answer questions if they are. But tweaked our urban forestry standards in a way that we're still meeting the intent of the urban forestry code. We're still mitigating for the loss of the urban tree canopy and doing it in such a way that still allows the development to occur, and it works seamlessly between the two. We did tweak our landscaping code. There was a few minor tweaks there. We also did do a negotiation on permitted uses, and Chris voluntarily agreed not to to record basically against the title that adult entertainment facilities cannot be constructed within the Peak 410 Business Park. Adult entertainment facilities are allowed in the East Town Zone, so this is a right that Chris is kind of giving up, and he was okay with that.
I did not know that.
Yeah, we have to have a zone in the city that allows for adult entertainment facilities. We've chosen East Town. So we negotiated with Chris to start this process that he will give up that permitted use that would be allowed on those properties. In addition, agreed that 85% of the building footprints will be dedicated to manufacturing, light industrial, and wholesale, and that all those other uses would be limited to 15%. So that's a joint agreement between the city and the developer. We will be doing a CEPA review as part of this process. And it's very important to understand that this is not just a CEPA for the development agreement, but a CEPA for all of the construction. So we streamlined the environmental review process. So from here on out, once the CEPA is complete later this month, Chris will be able to just pull building permits and do design review and not have to revisit that environmental permitting each time.
And Mr. Lamont, that is where my question came in, and I wanted to ask you about this, is the fact that it seems that in 15.1, they mentioned an artificially created wetland. What is that?
I'll cover that as we get through this presentation.
Okay. And is that going away as a result of this? It being artificially created, I was a little wondering.
We can definitely cover that.
Okay.
Yeah, let me get, it's not as easy as A and B.
Okay.
So we did work with the county to allow the city to act as a lead agency also for the county piece so that Chris, when he has to get any permits from the county, can rely on the CEPA decision that we're issuing. So we negotiated that with the county, so there's only one CEPA determination. As I said, there's a number of property transfers, releasing easements that we've already acquired, acquiring new easements, and then the big transfer of the property itself. There is significant transportation investment to include the construction of the required roundabout on 410, all the frontage improvements across, and I'll back up, probably easier a little bit if I back up, all the frontage improvements along the entire length of the property. Chris has been negotiating because we have a project two parcel over to complete all the frontage improvements to that parcel, and that's kind of still kind of being negotiated. All of the frontage roads on site, dedicating some right-of-way for some future frontage roads and the roundabout. They would be subject to traffic impact fees. The only credit that's being provided is for the roundabout because it is a capacity improvement project for the city. All of the frontage improvements, the internal roadway circulations, there's no credit for those. Those are just being constructed as part of the project. Drainage requirements, three large stormwater ponds will be built as part of this project, and those will be privately maintained. At one point, we were thinking that there would be a public facility out there. We've been able to negotiate with Chris that he would take on that responsibility, so all the stormwater and future maintenance of those stormwater ponds is no longer a city requirement. It would be stay with the developer for the life of the project. So all the road runoff, all of that goes to those stormwater ponds are kind of maintained by Chris in those three large stormwater ponds. Which we thought was a very nice part of the development agreement. Sewer, here we are also getting let me finish up with drainage. A big component of this also is we were able to negotiate that as part of the project, the decant facility on the city's property would be constructed. So this is a project that we would normally have to construct, but we were able to negotiate that as part of the project, they would build a decant facility to our specifications tied into the stormwater ponds they're constructing, the sewer lines that they're constructing, so that we can have our decant facility on that other piece of property that is a city property. Because that's not a required component of the project, we did agree to credit the stormwater connection charges that we would have acquired to then build the project at probably at a higher cost because it would be a public project. So that by the end of this project, that decant facility that we've always needed to be constructed will also be constructed as part of it. In the sewer, in addition,
we'll get there.
Right? Yeah. In addition to the, I'm just trying to walk through it so I don't forget anything.
Okay.
In addition to the sewer requirements that Chris has, the project would have to install across their property, we were able to negotiate the extension of the sewer line all the way out to 233rd. The city had already acquired the easements, so at this part of this project, we will be constructing pretty much the backbone of the entire Easttown sewer network, so to include also the going under 410 to tie into the sewer connections over there. Because the sewer line from the edge of the property to 233rd was not a requirement of the project, we did agree to provide a credit against the latecomers agreement that is out in Easttown for that construction of that sewer line. But we would still receive our full SDCs, and we would still receive all the other latecomers fees that we're entitled to right now. So all the projects that were developed out there, as soon as they connect the sewer, we would get about $500,000 in latecomers from them. Plus, I still think Chris will be, based on the amount we figured, there would still be about another $500,000 coming from this project in the latecomers agreement. And all those other properties developed, there's about $3 million in latecomers agreements that we would be acquiring once that sewer backbone is in place. Finally, on water infrastructure, the project will complete the rest of the water line in Easttown, dragging it from its current terminus in front of the Public Services Center, down to the project, across the project, and then back up 410 to its current terminus. And it's the last loop in the water system that we have provided.
City water
system. Yeah, city water system. Then there, the other part of the project from the Bowen property over in the yellow that you saw on that map is all Valley Royal, and they'll have to do work with the developer to do that water extension and that water development.
Hmm.
Sure. So environmental curricularies, I'll bring it down to the wetland. So originally when we did this, we believed that there was a naturally occurring wetland on the property. After reviewing some additional environmental documentation provided by a wetland consultant, it was determined that the wetland that existed on site was artificially created due to road runoff. So what that means is it's no longer regulated by us, but it's still regulated as possibly a water of the United States or under the Department of Ecology. So while we're not going to be requiring anything, there is a small section of that wetland needs to be filled in order to extend 97th. The developer will need to work with the Corps of Engineers and the Department of Ecology to provide the appropriate permitting and mitigation. So the artificially created wetland only exists for the city regulations, not those larger Clean Water Act regulations. So similar issue that happened on the Phil Creek Industrial Park, and we worked through that. There is a large mitigation wetland mitigation site proposed, and that will just have to work through its process. So that's what that artificially created wetland was. It was a wetland that occurred due to stormwater runoff. And so in those instances, if you can document it, then we don't regulate it as a wetland, but it's still considered a water of the U.S. under the Clean Water Act, typically, because it is related to a stream corridor. So there is going to be some federal permitting that has to occur, even for that limited impact fill. But the Corps will and the developer will work through that permitting process itself. And that's for the extension of 97th Street. And then the permitting, all the permitting will be done by the city, except for the stormwater pond, because it is unincorporated Pierce County. But we've coordinated with them, and they understand what needs to happen and are on board. And then, of course, the core permitting around that little wetland fill. So one of the big – oh.
There's also buffer enhancements.
Yeah, and then we're doing buffer enhancements on site, both to make the wetland that's there better and also to add tree canopy, because some of that buffer has been impacted. So it kind of – I think it's a win-win around the board for the development, for the environment, and for the project. One of the big differences in this development agreement than in other development agreements, there is a project milestones agreement. And if the project milestones are not met, the agreement can be terminated. There's a process that goes by it, and there's been lots of negotiations on how that happens. But there are certain milestones the developer has to hit in order to keep the agreement valid. Some development agreements just say, last for 20 years, and you do the project. This one we actually decided, no, we want to have milestones so that we're moving forward. So by June of 2024, all the stormwater ponds have to be completed. By December of 2024, all of the transportation improvements have to be done. Frontage improvements, roundabout, frontage roads, all completed. The water lake extension from 96th all the way to 410 has to be completed. Building number one has to be completed, and the city decant facility, and the first phase of the sewer construction has to be completed, which is from 96th all the way to the western edge or eastern edge of the project, so the kind of right here where my cursor is. In phase three, which is December of 2026, buildings three and five have to be completed. December of 2028, building four has to be complete, or two has to be completed, along with the rest of the sewer extension. And December 5 is when we have the last building. December 2030 is when the last building comes online and the buffer enhancement comes online. Chris is hoping to build it in about 5 to 6 years, but we wanted to set the milestones so if there's a hiccup in the economy, supply chains, pandemics, we built in some buffer. But we're hoping to move faster, but we didn't want to have to come back to council every time there was a small tweak. So we built in some conservative buffers into that project milestone, because it does, the agreement is structured in such a way that the council, with providing appropriate notices, can cancel the agreement if that milestone is not met. And so the developer loses out on their parts of the agreement.
Well, I do appreciate that foresight. That had the most to do with my questioning, such as what if we were to have supply chain issues with the decant facility? I saw a cost, an estimated cost of $750,000 in there. But and my question was going to be, was there any foresight into supply chain and COVID and all of that with this particular agreement? So I do appreciate that.
Yeah, originally what Chris had proposed to us was a 5-year development agreement, and I was like, if everything happens perfectly. So I kind of talked to Chris and said, you know what, maybe we build this as a 10-year agreement and put in the milestones in there a little bit broader, just in case something happens that's outside of our control.
Now, how does it work with the mandatory roundabout that has to be put in, considering that's on a state highway? Are we getting anything, any contribution from the state in putting that in?
No.
Okay.
So just as Councilman Swatman was talking about a road around Allen Hill.
Yeah.
And his $15 million that he doesn't want to put there.
Oh, of course not.
So these public improvements are going to be funded by us.
Okay.
So the city will not be on the hook for that. There's design, all that will be done in this first phase. Yeah, there was a lot of consideration on the milestones to make sure we could tolerate the cost and budget out the expenditure.
Okay.
So that nobody is helping the cost.
Okay.
But there is some TIF credit looking at and some other opportunities inside for the water lines and stormwater discharge that have offset some of those costs.
Yeah, there are some credits for when we got things that were above and beyond what we could require from the developer. So if we got something like a decant facility, there's no rule in any state law or federal law that says they have to build the city a decant facility for the city
on private
property and then dedicate it back to the city. So we did provide some credits from a funding source that would have been used to build that decant facility. So yes, there's a credit, but we're getting the facility that we would have used those funds for, and we're probably getting it at a discounted rate because one, Chris will be the developer will be buying significantly more concrete than we would be, so the price per unit would be cheaper, and it's a private project versus a publicly bidded project. So there's some cost savings there. And just to follow up my presentation, then we can open up to questions generally. The last leg of this next steps is tonight we're having the presentation on the development agreement. We'll have an exec session later tonight on the purchase and sales agreement. On September 27th, there's a public hearing. On October 4th, per council rules, if there is testimony, that's the night to discuss the testimony, and then we're expecting final action on October 11th so that the developer can kick loose the civil engineering staff full bore so that we can get the next phase of this, which is the design work, beginning in early 2023.
Well, thank you, Councilmember Sullivan. And one commentary before I open the floor to Councilmember Evans, and that is about this time last year, prior to me taking office, I had heard very good things about you, Mr. Lear, and I can say over the last year that has certainly been proven. I like what I've heard so far and like what I read in the developer agreement. That being said, Councilmember Evans.
Thank you very much for presenting this. I know this has been a long process in a week. Like you said, it was October, November of last year, and then I think December we ended up getting it in front of the council. Mm-hmm. I know you'd mentioned it before. But one of the things that we're going to discuss in the exec session is the sale price. What is the offset that?
Oh God! Really?
No, not the,
well, the offset.
What is the contribution that you're putting forth that if it went to someone else would be on the city?
So
the roundabout, the sewer, all of that.
So basically, it's people in the development world don't really expect to build a building that you're required to run a mile of water line and a mile of sewer line. And it's extremely onerous, and that's why nothing happens in these towns. So working with the city and Jason to sort this out and create this plan, the goal was to provide all that infrastructure, not with city dollars, with private dollars. And in order to offset that, the goal was to purchase the price at a discounted rate because there's a thing called an LID. Do you know what that is? Local Improvement District.
Okay.
So they did that on Valentine in Sumner. They went through and they just built this incredible road, great street lamps, and then they charged all the property owners. And that's one way to develop, and that way you create your area. But that puts all the risk on the city, and it's all on public dollars. And it's a lot of work to do all these things. The amount of different engineers that have to create every component of the job is incredible, and a different engineer for roundabout. And the frontage, and then the site, and then the storm, and then the structure. It's crazy. So taking all that privately and keeping a design team that can do the scale seemed like a logical plan. The lift that the city's going to get on a private expenditure, what we're anticipating is about $14 million. And since we started talking about this, COVID hit, cost doubled. So this is not in my favor, and that's why the timeline increase is nice, because you're not under the gun to deliver every building all in milestones. We push those out. But our intention is to get all that infrastructure because we want it there. It makes sense, and our goal was all this started by just trying to put the sidewalk down 410, and it just grew from there. So.
And one thing to consider, too, the $15 million lift that we would get from all the improvements if we would build those, as those who sat in the EDC committee
would normally build those, though.
Some of them we would have, some of them we wouldn't have to.
Well, what would we build, though? We wouldn't normally build them.
Yeah, there's nothing would happen.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But,
no, I'm not. Your deal is great, Chris. I'm not arguing that point. I'm just, you know, making sure that the public doesn't think that the city normally, you know, builds infrastructure.
Well, for example,
we don't.
Well, that's where the DLID comes in.
Or the TIF,
exactly.
Or the traffic impact fee. So if one project did not pick up the roundabout, we would collect traffic impact fees from all the developers, have no roundabout, and then we would have to go out and build the roundabout.
Well, they wouldn't be able to build without building the roundabout.
Well,
it'd be incredibly difficult.
It depends on
a roundabout. What would it be? A lift?
Well, no, but what's supposed to be there is supposed to be a light, right? It's supposed to be a
gap. No.
No, it's supposed to be around.
It has to be a roundabout.
No, but 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Right.
You're like,
have to be around.
So, but I guess we're getting off topic. I guess what I'm saying is, depending on projects, yes, some of the infrastructure would be built from the city. Some of it would not be built from the city.
But when has the city built any infrastructure? It's what I'm making Chris's case, right? Because, you know, private developers develop all the infrastructure and give it to the city. The private developers pay the TIF. They pay for the traffic impact, and then they create the road. They put the road down, and then they give it to the city.
Correct. And what I'm saying is, if there was not one project that would pick up the roundabout,
right?
Example 214th. Lots of projects have happened, but we need to improve that signal. So we've been collecting impact fees. So eventually, someday, the city's going to be on the hook for making those improvements
with developer contributions.
With developer contributions. Don't disagree with that.
There you go.
The other part of this, by front loading all of the infrastructure by the private developer at the beginning, makes every other property out there marketable and developable.
Yeah.
So there's a snowballing effect. And if you look the way we structured this, before Chris has all of his buildings built, we have all the infrastructure we need so the rest of those properties can develop. So it's also a cascading effect that makes every other one of those properties out there more valuable and quicker to develop because the infrastructure needed for them that they couldn't afford for their smaller slice now becomes a pensable project. So it has an uplifting effect larger than just the improvement value itself.
And one other thing to note is that everything on the south side of the freeway is smaller lots, which the reason we were able to develop the Peter Building and Tunnel Creek Building 2, they were on septic. And so if you have a small 1 or 2 acre lot, you can't chew up half that for septic and half that for storm and then put a building on it.
Right. Exactly.
So you essentially have all of the south side of East Town minus the Ogle property, which is the AJ, the Ebert development there. All of it is undevelopable without these services coming across.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Jason said. And to my knowledge, I know that developers are jumping on all that stuff right now. Because this word got out last week about this.
Yeah. You got inverse.
Councilmember McClyman, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. I'm really confused about the roundabout. Now, I know we've had a lot of discussion about roundabouts in the past. The council actually expressed the policy that it did not choose to put a roundabout at 214th. I don't understand why the roundabout is viewed as mandatory here. I understand that we have to create a situation where the right of way exists to turn large vehicles into this project, but why a roundabout? Why is everybody saying it's mandatory?
Because it is what the state of Washington requires for 410.
Because it is mandatory.
Yeah, because
it's going to have to go into 214th, even though the council voted it down, and more than likely we have to pay for it.
so let's separate 214th in this one. So,
well, no, Steve. Because the problem with that is traffic flow. You're going to, you know, roundabouts restrict traffic flow to 40 miles an hour. Right, that's all there is to it, and. Well-metered lights, given modern technology, can beat that nowadays.
Well,
so,
right. There's a couple of things to answer that question. The first is the speed limit on 410 there is only, I think it's only 45 now for that section of 410. And two, because 410 is a state highway,
yeah.
We had to do what they call an intersection control analysis. and a traffic impact analysis that had to be approved by the state of Washington. The state of Washington, through both the intersection control analysis and the traffic impact analysis, is requiring that if there is going to be an intersection at that location, it has to be a roundabout. This is not a city road. It is a state road. So if we want to have the intersection there, it has to be a roundabout. Yep. This and one of the big issues with the 214th roundabout was pedestrian crossings, which is not as same of an issue here because it's mainly an industrial area. The TIA has shown that the roundabout will work with the larger trucks. We really don't have an option unless we want to completely blow up the development agreement and go back to square one with the Washington State Department of Transportation.
No. It's too late for the development agreement. I have Section 7.9.1 is my favorite section in development agreement. So, no, we can't blow that up. But I just wanted to have a discussion.
Oh,
I wanted to have a discussion with the council because this is the only time I can do that, thanks to OPMA, that we did express a policy of no roundabouts, and now we're going to do roundabouts, right?
So, but I thought that was only on that one intersection, Kelly. I thought that was just that intersection that we were having an issue with, was okay. My recollection. I could be wrong, right?
All right.
Oh, Deputy Mayor Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So, I was one of the big people against the roundabout deal at 214th, and the reasoning for that was that 214th is a city road, and it is a super busy road, and you're crossing a state highway, which is very busy, with a city road that was very busy. This is a completely different deal. Roundabouts actually, believe it or not, actually kind of work when you're talking about like a three road type DRT intersection, that kind of thing. So it's different in that aspect, and that was one of the reasons I was totally against the 214th one. But this is, I see this as completely different, and I just throw it out there.
Oh, hey. Yeah, Mr. Weir. I just want to say, as a person who's trying to craft this whole program, I've been incredibly humbled when you talk to Washington State about what you'd like to do for them. And they tell you how it's going to be.
Yeah, nice. Huh?
So while we all might have opinions on how things should be, they have engineers that have been testing and planning and learning, and then you hire your traffic impact analysis engineer, and then he tells you the same thing, and then they tell each other, and then you're just going, what?
I know.
But and here we are. So the key that is important with this roundabout is that the frontage road was required. I personally don't think the frontage road should even be there. But it was required, and this is the access point to it. And it'll almost be identical to the one that was created in Fife, just north of the old Emerald Queen Casino on the west side of I-5, I believe.
Yeah.
And so if you guys want to see how it works, you should go drive down there. It's beautiful.
Actually, and a great example is the one in Kent that they did, too, on Willis Road and right past there.
I mean, really, it's going to be a two-lane roundabout.
And the nice thing about the roundabout at this location is this portion of 410 is divided median. So if you come out of, say, Mazatlan or some of the other facilities, instead of trying to make one of the illegal left-hand U-turns or having to go all the way down to 233rd to make that, you know, loop around the block, this will allow for those users to come half block and then swing around the U-turn and then go back down to 410. So it does have – and it works better with the semi-trucks instead of having to come to a complete stop. On 410 and then get going again. They can flow around the corner and into the group.
That's a great.
Thank you.
Your turn.
Okay. I hope that answers your questions, Councilmember Kleinman.
It does. Thank you.
You can't make an illegal left turn in Mazatlan because you can't defy the laws of physics. They have big boundaries.
I was talking about
the
RV place and they loop kind of into the RV place and then back onto the road.
I mean, that's not very
illegal.
Frowned upon, but I don't know if it's legal.
All right, Councilmember Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Change the subject. Fennel Creek, top of the wetlands, we moved around. That's where our whole headwaters is, with Fennel Creek up there. What are you adjusting by moving the wetlands around? Is that going to affect it? What Fennel Creek at all?
Oh, go ahead, Ms. Sullivan.
The these wetlands are not on Fennel Creek. The way Fennel Creek comes in is it comes in, and before it gets to the project site, it actually heads north and it is on the north side of 96. So the wetland that we're messing with isn't associated with the headwaters of Fennel Creek. It's a little, it's a subsidiary of it. Second of all, the mitigation wetland that we're proposing is right next to Fennel Creek. And so there'll actually be an uplift because the stormwater will discharge through the pond, be cleaned, feed into the wetland, and then feed into the water into Fennel Creek.
That's actually our option B.
Okay.
So just to clarify what the wetland is, because people might be thinking that we're moving a creek or something. A large pipe, 2 foot diameter, was put under 410, flowing road water from the north or from the south side to the north, and that just dumped onto Bowen's property on the west side of this property.
Oh, wow.
It created a little trough in the last 20 years, 15 years as it did that. And that was what was non-jurisdictional wetland identified because it's man-made dumping of water out of a big culvert. Where Jason referenced Fennel Creek is very similar to what we dealt with at Fennel Creek, where farmers 50 years ago made a ditch in the field, which then flowed water and now became a man-made wetland, which then flowed through a culvert and we can go there. So what we're doing is there's an area where this trench flowed and it created a little bit of soppy dirt on the northwest corner of this property, which is right next to an identified wetland on the Compass Point property. Sorry, I gotta take deeper breaths. So it's right next to an identified wetland on the Compass Point property. So we're going to be moving the first plan A that we're going to work with the state and all the various agencies is to move this little bit of wetland, which is also coincidentally right where the frontage road goes. I mean, east to west across.
Literally right to the middle.
It's right. Like, if you drew up a spot on a map for the worst spot of the road ever, that's the spot. But luckily, there's a little bit of area around with one of our parking areas. And we have a map, and it's identified in the map if you're interested. We're just going to move the wetland a little bit to the west and into this area, and you're allowed to do a 1-to-2 kind of move transfer situation. If you're doing that, the option two is if that's unacceptable for whatever reason, we can create new wetland over where Jason's saying, right at the outflow of the storm pond, which will flow into Fennel Creek. Sorry.
No, that's a better explanation. Thanks, Chris.
Well, I appreciate the history lesson and the foresight.
Yeah, if you want to come and learn about Easttown, then.
Yeah, I know. He's got his job.
I've walked it all over other ones and flooding stuff, so I know.
All right, are we ready to move on? Oh, Councilman Schlock.
No, yeah, just thank you, Mr. Mayor, Ms. Comet. Congratulations, Chris, for staying with us for so long. It's been quite the journey. I know that you've done so much to stay with, you know, through the hard times and good times and working with city staff. That's got to be all kinds of fun to get to this point now where we're at, and it's really amazing that you've been able to assemble a project like this and really, you know, contribute to the city in this fashion. So it's been fantastic. We'll see. Hopefully we'll be able to close this up and get you moving here pretty soon. With any luck, we'll see how everything else turns out. My comment would be, of course, you know, it is a two-party agreement, of course, and we're just, the city just does such an excellent job with developer agreements. They're just straightforward. And the reason I mentioned two-party, of course, is because if it needs to be changed, it needs to be changed, and it's pretty easy to change. So if there is any issues out there, guess who gets to change them would be us and you. So, yeah, exactly, right? So it sounds like something, if the city council agrees to do it, and, you know, 2 years from now, and I'm off somewhere else, and you're like, wow, you know, that was a really dumb idea to limit this X, Y, Z or something, that just feel free to come back to the city and say, hey, we need to look at this again. So hopefully they'll, you know, they'll have that option to look at that. So don't think you're completely closed out on the particular option, because I'm definitely not one that likes to, you know, tie your hands behind your back when you're trying to run a business. So
I would like to counter that point in that we have the success of Fennel Creek Phase 1.
Yes.
Two, working with the city, we were able to identify the pinch points.
And yeah.
This agreement is from an experienced developer in the city with staff that worked with that process. So I think I feel confident enough to actually sign it personally.
Right.
I wasn't going to feel confident I wouldn't sign it.
Exactly,
it's
yeah.
scary to commit to all this stuff.
Yeah, it is, and that's what I'm kind of wondering about, and making sure that you're not going to, you know, go on any float planes with any suicidal pilots and end up in the Puget Sound somewhere. That's a risk for obviously the city, right? Because if we sell the land to you,
outright, and 2 years from now you decide that this doesn't work for some odd reason, and you just, you know, motor on to bigger lands, right? I don't know. How does the city, where are we at that? Has anybody, that risk scenario, you know, what do we do there, right?
If I have a change of heart, how do we handle that?
Well, yeah, sure. If something unfortunate happens, like I said, no float plans for you.
Well, the key about this thing is, I don't think you, where we're at with this, with the level of investment, just to get to this point now is,
oh yeah,
we're about $800,000 in the program,
yeah,
in all the surveys.
Sure.
Yeah. Culture events. Yeah. I mean, the amount of effort to this point, number one, should show the dedication to deliver.
Oh yeah.
The second aspect, again, is delivering phase one and two final great. The third aspect is that we're a family business, been in this area for 1981.
Yeah.
So if we wanted to fly the coop, not fly the coop,
it's going to be hard, huh?
We could have done it before.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So the reality is we have, hired Andrew Lear,
mm-hmm,
to be the CFO of the development organization. My wife and I, Riley's working with him on finance.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Lear used to actually start Beautify Bonnie Lake.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's been in the community for quite a long time.
Yeah.
I met him on Saturday.
Yeah, but, you know, because, of course, just from a risk perspective, again, you know, completely, you know, on board with what you're doing there, it's like 5 years from now, you've built a couple of buildings and you have quite a bit of the infrastructure maybe or maybe not done, right? And then, you know, something happens where it's done. You know, you're not meeting the milestones or something, and the city says, you know, no, this isn't working. We've already sold you the land at that point, is my assumption. You know, you've already closed on the land. So now where am I as a city, right? You know?
I think that I understand what you're saying, and I think the challenge is 20 years, nothing's happened.
Yeah. No, yeah, yeah. I agree, but, you know, I ride a bicycle, too, in spandex, so, you know, I don't...
That was one of the commentaries that I was making.
Right?
I certainly appreciate the risk here that has been thought of in this agreement.
The bigger risk is, what if the Fed raises interest rates?
But that's on you, right? That's not on us. That's unfortunately on you.
Those types of outside impacts really pressure this development, and that's where Jason, with the timeline,
yeah,
and with the way they've laid out this agreement, I think it's done a really good job of trying to weigh the benefit negatives.
Yeah, and we can always extend those. Like I said, I'm not worried any of the details of whatsoever the agreement. Two-party agreements are like, yeah, whatever. You know, if you need to change it, we do that all the time.
Well, this was a very productive conversation. It was a very excellent presentation, Mr. Sullivan.
So going forward...
Yeah, you laid out the plan.
What we need to know, is there anything in this agreement that is a showstopper? Because if there is, then we need to go back and negotiate with Chris. If there's not, what we would do is finish off the public hearing. There may be something that comes up there. We don't know. And then we would be back on October 11th with a resolution basically authorizing the mayor to sign. And I know we have the exact section on the purchase and sales agreement, so I'm just kind of assuming that. To sign both the purchase sales agreement and the development agreement. So,
oh yes, Mr. Lear. One other thing too to consider is, there's a thing called highest best use. When you develop a piece of land, what is the highest and best use that you can put forward on that piece of property?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very early on, we agreed to the gentleman's club clause, but there's another one called mini storage. No mini storage construction.
Okay.
Because mini storage doesn't bring any real job value, job creation to any community that they're in. They provide a storage facility. You could be out in the middle of nowhere, but it shouldn't be in a key corridor, transit corridor. So I understand that you guys worked through maybe reducing that use in Easttown, which made that point null and void, but I think our goal is to build highest best use product.
Yes.
And these buildings, as we've seen already in what we've done, deliver that for the community. And the second point I just want to make quickly is, in the back of the room, John Norquist is the man.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't see John. Sorry.
So John Norquist is the man that bought Bowen's property. So Bowen, for 5 years, was not willing to participate with our program.
Mm-hmm.
And the TIA required the road to go through the property.
Yeah.
So John stepped forward and was able to transact with them and has been brought into the project. So he was the city's steward, and challenges in that property is linchpin, but the Bowen property ended up proving challenging and Just, if you hear it, call and mention his name.
Yeah. And we certainly appreciate your consideration.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. On this, since we do have a plan, Mr. Sullivan, as far as I don't know, do any of the council members have a major impediment, showstopper, as Mr. Sullivan stated?
They're done.
Okay, so we're just going to proceed with the with the calendar and on how it's been planned. All right. So, thank you, Mr. Lear. You know, you could certainly stay up here if you want, but.
Yeah.
All right. Next, we have a discussion on the rules of order for council meetings and workshops. Madam Clerk, the floor is yours.
So, I have provided the council members a spreadsheet that shows the rules of order for Sturgis and Roberts' rule of order. I'm hoping everybody got a chance to look at that because I wasn't planning on going page by page on that.
With their magnifying glasses, because I'm telling you, it strained my eyes.
I also included what our current code says, and our code is a mixture of both rules currently. And we've gone through Chapter 2 and discussed amendments that council would like to see. Before I can do those amendments, I just need to know which rules of order you would like to follow so I can update that part of the code and then continue with the rest.
Is this a time-sensitive thing, Mr. Mayor, or what are we working on with this proposal?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a time-sensitive.
I didn't know
thing.
If the council wants to wade into
direction
this,
on
like half-hour discussion this evening also or not, right? That's the deputy mayor's kind of like, well, I don't know.
It's one of the things I think we wanted to bring forward. We want to continue talking and moving forward with. Mm-hmm. However, it is not a time-sensitive issue that has to be done right now.
Yeah, per se. And Mr. Vodopich, did you have a contribution to it says on my agenda that the floor would be yours at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, what? Oh, I'm looking at it right here.
You're wrong.
I can think of the executive. All right. Well, it's I can tell you, Madam Clerk, I did read over the both the Roberts and the Sturgis rules on this. I do agree with the deputy mayor's that it's not necessarily a time-sensitive issue right now. And and I certainly appreciate all of the work that you put in on this. It is a lot of information and a lot of volume.
Because there's a lot of details in these that I think that, you know, are germane for discussion. Lot of intricate little weird details. It's like any one of them is worth kind of discussing for a few minutes.
No, and that's true. And the time sensitivity aspect of it that you mentioned, Councilmember Swatman, is probably germane, to use your word, to discuss prior to us getting into our budget conversations that will be coming up in the upcoming weeks, which probably we need to follow the rules on that one. Otherwise, we would be here until 9 o'clock every session.
I'd rather us go through this, kind of out some highlights that would be different for us. We're not following right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm trying to think, okay, which way are we actually, or what are we doing? And I realize you've got to separate this way, what our council on the right-hand side is, all of us and so on, but can I go through it briefly or follow us? That'd be...
Because even before that, you even have to decide which kind of rule set you want to use, right?
Right.
Because we have a customized version of, what is Sturgis, right?
Yeah, hybrid.
Which apparently is my knowledge now that isn't used that much anymore nowadays. Maybe, I mean, I don't know. I think that the American code is standard.
Well, the American code is Sturgis.
It's
Roberts that the one is the
Roberts, and then there's a version of Roberts that's kind of the more succinct version, as opposed to the 500-page version.
Oh, yes, I can't remember.
Is what we're doing broken?
Not necessarily, but I think there's a couple of things, because I think rightly so, it might be very good to update from Sturgis or not. I don't know. No, it's not significantly broken in my opinion. Of course, because I wrote it, but.
I've been doing this for 10 years. I haven't had a real problem the past 10 years. Mm. I have a hiccup here and there, and that would be for them to point out to us and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think part of the issue was that, say, like AWC does training specifically to Robert's rules, whereas we were doing something different.
Right.
They're not significantly different. There are some nuances. There's obviously, you can see as you read through it, there are some differences. This is, Roberts is a little more formal, and whatnot. And so, the training, I think, is one of the things that there's really no trainings that I've seen recently for Sturgis.
Right.
There is for the Roberts.
Right.
So it's one of those things, again, it's something to bring up, for us to talk about. Do we want to continue doing what we're doing? Do we want to change it? Do we want to do, you know, something where we can get some training on it or not.
Yeah, because if we changed, you know, in my mind, there's some nuance, you know, Roberts is written for organization, legislative bodies that aren't necessarily a strong council, you know, and when we went through that process with Sturgis, we recognized that and kind of made sure that our procedures recognize that there's a strong mayor involved.
Right.
And that's with the quorum issues and different things about who's voting, and made sure that those integrated with that Sturgis at that point in time. So if Sturgis isn't the one that's really the one to use nowadays, because they kind of left the scene 20 years ago, now it's like, oh, we need to use Roberts, whatever version, then we should, in my mind, take Roberts and, you know, make sure that it aligns with what we want to do. And that process, I think, is going to take a little bit of time to go through.
And Councilmember Swatman, I believe you're correct on that, in the fact that I believe that our council and myself, we need to go through a little bit more thoroughly than I believe any of us have done tonight, highlight what you think is important, how we're doing it, and presenting that back to Madam Clerk or the Clerk's office so that we can get something streamlined and uniformity of understanding as far as how to properly proceed, what will be considered a valid record as to what we do, because to answer Councilmember Evans' problems, I don't think there's been much broken, but there have been times where the record and the voting process has been muddled, and we do need to get clarity on that to make sure that we have
our code just uses both right now.
Right.
So we're trying to, you know, go through all of our policies and codes and trying to
Yeah, exactly. We should
There you go. Okay, Deputy Mayor Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would, if what I'm hearing is correct, I would make a motion that we table this for now. We can bring it back at a later date. So, yeah, perhaps because it's going to take a while. Yeah,
because we should get together as a small committee or something, possibly, or whatever, you know, discussion group or something, just between a couple, Deputy Mayor, and maybe do some, you know, individual with the ferret out the version you want to use and say, okay, this is everybody's thinking, let's use Roberts, whatever, and then, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and in getting into the rules of order, Deputy Mayor made a motion. Anybody want to second it?
Second.
Any discussion?
It's just for guidance.
What we've had?
Just for discussion tonight.
It's just for guidance tonight.
Yeah,
don't have to table it.
It's actually, if you're reading the rules, you do.
which rules? Yeah.
Our parliamentarian.
She's right here.
The deputy. Know,
your background in.
She's been sitting here.
Oh, I mean, my general advice would probably be to pick Robert's Rules of Order, just because that's what's used by most cities, and with their, plan to be eventually to hire a contract city attorney who will be your parliamentarian. That's what that person or law firm will be most familiar with. And then if that law firm's sending in other attorneys to sub because, you know, somebody's on vacation or they have another city, that's what they're going to be most familiar with. And so that'll probably make it easier for an attorney advising counsel whenever there is a sticky point with voting or whatever.
Okay. So we table it until January after the budget. Okay. All right, on that note, there is a change in the RCW for our executive session or executive meeting. We will now adjourn to the council meeting and go into an executive session for 30 minutes per RCW 42301101C to consider the minimum price at which real estate will be offered for sale or lease when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of decreased price with no action to follow. So, therefore, we are now adjourned.
You need to get fucked.